Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is June 11th, 2020, and my guest is Josh Williams. He is the CEO and co-founder of Forte, a blockchain gaming company. Our topic today is the gaming industry and learning about what exactly is a blockchain gaming company. Josh, welcome to Econ Talk.
Hi, Russ. So happy to be here. It's a big honor.
I want to remind listeners we're recording via Zoom during the pandemic. We may not achieve our usual audio quality. Please be patient and forgiving. I also hope this makes it to YouTube as a video. All 730-plus episodes of Econ Talk are now available on YouTube in audio form, and increasingly we are putting up video as well. Please go to YouTube, search for Econ Talk, and subscribe if that appeals to you. Josh, let's begin with the gaming industry. How many gamers are out there, and do we have any idea of what that number means? How do we count them?
Sure. Yeah, the games industry is really huge. There's about 3 billion gamers worldwide. So the vast majority of people that are connected to the internet in any way or have a computing device of any kind. We can count those numbers because there's pretty detailed reports, you know, from the industry, from publicly traded companies, as well as from data firms that specialize in this stuff. And so a lot of people play games, and that's a massive change from, you know, where it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago, where really gaming was confined to a pretty small group of people, you know, relatively speaking, who purchased, you know, a home computer for the purposes of gaming or a console for the purposes of gaming. So it's really become, you know, nearly ubiquitous now.
The only Econ Talk episode in this area that we've done before, really, is with Edward Castronova. And that was on the exodus to the virtual world. It was in 2008, which was very prescient of Edward. And he was very focused at that point on Second Life and World of Warcraft and the potential for doing social science experimentation within those games. But we also talked a lot about the incredible thing that people were spending time inside virtual worlds, which then was particularly strange. It's still a little bit strange to a lot of people today. But that world of what are called MMORPGs, massive multiplayer online role-playing games.
You got it.
Has exploded. World of Warcraft was one of the early ones. But there's now popular ones like League of Legends. What is the experience like of playing a game like League of Legends on your computer? Try to give listeners and viewers a feel for what that's about.
Sure. Yeah, so League of Legends is a competitive game, but it's also cooperative. So you team up with a group of people online, and that's part of what's really cool about games like that and most games today is you team up with other people, you connect with them, and you basically engage in, you know, teamwork and strategy to try to beat an opposing team. And so you can be connected with people from anywhere around the world. And these games are pretty complicated. And if you see, you know, both adults and kids playing games today, they're really engaged in systems of mastery. They take these complex systems, like in League of Legends, where you have to think about, you know, your little character, your avatar in the game world, and how you want to configure them so that you, you know, can play to your strengths maybe as a person and what you're interested in, but also synergize well with or cooperate well with the other people on your team. You have to think about what the opponents, you know, might do and what their configurations might look like. And besides all that, you know, you have to make real-time decisions in the game about, you know, how to upgrade your character and also just how to play. So this is, what's really cool about games is they present you with these massive systems that you have to learn. And they're very complicated, and you develop mastery over time, and you overcome challenges, and you know have these great feelings of cooperation and competition and achievement, and it's really meaningful for people that play these games.
So when I'm playing on a team, am I playing with strangers or friends, or I can choose either one?
It can be both. Yeah. So often, you know, you'll play with real world friends. Very often you'll meet strangers online and they might become, you know, friends.
Sure.
And that's a big part of what happens. You know, for me growing up playing games as a kid and with the introduction of multiplayer games like World of Warcraft that you mentioned, yeah, I developed friends that, yeah, I had no idea who they were in real life, but we became, you know, actual friends over time.
And when we're playing this game, let's say we're on it, you and I are on a team together. We're wearing a headset. We're communicating to each other through the headset. Are we speaking in English? Or are we just using the keyboard to communicate? How are we communicating?
Yeah, generally speaking in English, if there's voice, often keyboard, and some games have sort of, you know, pretty elaborate emote systems, so you can communicate, you know, even without words or text and, you know, point people in the right direction or identify an objective or share goods with each other. So, you know, there's these complex social systems that really evolve in these games that are really fascinating.
So in League of Legends, for example, have you played it, Josh?
I have.
Okay. I have.
I'm not very good. I'm not very good.
Me neither. What would I experience visually, besides this cooperative element and the goal of achieving something in the game? I'm going to see myself in a virtual world, and I'm going to explore that world looking for devices, tools, weapons. But we have goals as part of the game that we're trying to achieve in competition or adversarially with another team or other teams, plural, I assume. What am I seeing, and how do I move through that world? We're not talking about virtual reality. I'm not wearing a set of goggles that I'm walking and feeling myself going forward. How do I go forward in this game? How do I move?
Yep. So it depends, of course, on each game. But generally, yeah, it's on a screen. You know, your phone or your TV or your laptop, your desktop. And in some games, you know, you're in a fully immersive 3D environment where, you know, you have a key or a controller input or a swipe kind of gesture on your phone to move forward, move backward, jump up and down, and you really feel immersed. It's either first person, you know, so from the perspective of kind of your eyes as a camera, or third person. League of Legends in particular is more of a top-down view. So there's a camera that oversees, you know, your character kind of from the top and an area around you. And the world is just one map. And so players get to know the map really, really intimately. And, you know, they know every little kind of trick and mechanic on the map to, like, really get competitive. It's kind of like playing on the same, you know, same football field every time, or a very similar football field every time you play a game of football or soccer.
Or more like maybe like a baseball stadium where there's nooks and crannies and the
yes.
way the outfield fence is configured, and I've got to
yes.
I get used to it. So I know where I am after a while, not physically. I know where I'm located on the map. I recognize that's landmarks right. and so on. And what's the goal?
So the
typically,
goal,
you sometimes, know, whatever.
Yeah, the goal, again, varies from game to game. Sometimes it's a competitive game like League of Legends, where the goal is to win a match, and it's you and a few other people against another team that's banded together, and you know your goal is to win. Sometimes it's pretty self-directed, like in World of Warcraft, as you mentioned. There are a multitude of goals, and you really self-select into what you prefer to do. So it could be things like, you know, you want to become a really great dungeon battler and overcome the most, you know, extreme challenges in the game and be one of the first people maybe in the world to overcome these things. Some people just want to, you know, relax and have a good time playing with their friends and, you know, maybe learn things like crafting in the game, which are ways to take resources from the world and craft goods that you can then sell to other players for the virtual currencies inside of the game and buy stuff that you want.
What would be the kind of things I would craft inside the game?
So, again, varies a lot game to game, but you can craft gear for other players, so pieces of equipment that people can use to upgrade their statistics or their abilities in the game, kind of become more powerful. You can create tools so that people can use to, you know, tend a farm that they might have. And so you kind of start to get a picture that these virtual worlds are very rich. People spend a lot of time in them. They spend a lot of money in them. They connect with people. They really care about the achievements in the games, and they have these really rich, you know, systems and actually economies that develop inside of these games today. And what's really fascinating now is there's this kind of revolution in the works. I think that players are starting to earn real income from these virtual worlds, which is fascinating.
No, we're going to talk about that. So what, obviously there are many different ways to measure the size of this industry. The ways that I've heard from, they're mind blowing. So, because again, it's kind of under the radar for a lot of us older folk. Give us some measures of quote, how big this is in monetary terms. So it's 3 billion people. Of course, some of them might play once and not play, you know, again. But the revenue is maybe a better measure of how big this industry is. What are some revenue measures?
Yeah. So there's there's about 3 billion people that play games every day. About 3 billion people a day that play games. So it's really massive. Yeah. and revenue wise, you know, the industry is about $150 billion a year in direct revenue.
What does that mean, direct?
So that's, you know, generally takes the form of either purchasing a game up front, or the majority of that revenue, about $100 billion of it, is purchasing virtual goods inside of games, virtual goods and virtual currencies inside of games. So, you know, another massive game today is a game called Fortnite.
Heard of it.
Yep, heard of it. Yeah, it's incredibly popular. A few hundred million people a month play just that, just that game. And, you know, in the game, you can buy customizations, you know, skins for your character. So you have a character in the game and you can just customize their outfits and the way they look. And the game does a couple billion dollars a year in revenue just from those cosmetic purchases. So it's, you know, virtual goods in the game.
So it's $150 billion of money that's changing hands, either from gamers to the makers of games, or within the 100 of that 150 are people exchanging with each other stuff they've built, and are they buying it also from the game maker?
So it's all that. So this is $150 billion in direct revenue, meaning it's from the developer. So they're buying these goods from the developer, or they're purchasing the game from the developer. Now, beyond that, there's this, you know, today what's more amorphous, but, you know, in the future, I think will be much bigger and much clearer. The secondary market, which is harder to get exact numbers around, but is also really large. There's a game called Counter-Strike Go, which is a competitive shooting game. You know, it's a tactical combat game. And in that game, the game itself does, depending on the year, it's been around for 10 or 15 years now. It's a really long-lived title, like many of these games are. And the game does about $200 to $300 million a year in direct revenue. So players purchasing goods from the developer. And it's free to play, so which is really cool. You don't have to pay anything to start to play the game. And it's really just you choose to purchase if you want, you know, different goods in the game.
You can play totally naked, you know, if you want, or wearing like dad shorts, you know, something that's humiliating. Right. But if you really want to look decent, you got to spend money from the buying it. Okay.
That's right. And there's ways to earn, you know, cosmetics and skins in the games. But that does about $200 to $300 million a year in direct revenue. But that's a game that enables a secondary market kind of inside the game and in the game's periphery. And that does, again, there's not exact figures for this, but depending on the year, anywhere from $2 to $5 billion a year in GMV. So turnover of, you know, players trading goods with each other.
Wow.
And what's there's that other term? Games that gross merchandise value. Okay. So basically just the gross value of transactions across things. It's, you know, maybe similar to a concept like, you know, GDP. It's the total measure of all the goods in the game.
So that's kind of extraordinary. Now, there are also people, and this is what really blew my mind, not knowing anything about it. There are also people who earn income playing the game. So they're for their tournaments. Talk about the different ways that players make money, and that there are a lot of professionals, people making a living full time in this world. So tell us what they do.
Totally right. Yeah. So there's a few different ways players are starting to make income from playing games. And it's all kind of on the fringes of games today. And that's certainly where it started. But now it's kind of getting folded more and more into the game world and being embraced more and more by game developers around the globe. So the first way is in what's called esports. So competitive teams and organizations that are put together entirely to field talent from within games, you know, from within these virtual worlds, find the best players, recruit them, and form, you know, professional teams that compete in these big tournaments for games. And today's the largest esports titles like League of Legends, like you mentioned, are massive events for gamers. The League of Legends World Championships last year had about 100 million viewers, 100 million viewers. So, you know, comparable to the Super Bowl, you know, it's bigger than, you know, many sporting events and concerts and, you know, big cultural events. And that was just for the championship. That same game, League of Legends, you know, they'll actually sell tickets to a physical arena and people will congregate and watch, you know, these players sit there on computers and play games. But it's actually really thrilling. You know, you cheer for your team and they sold out, you know, last year they sold out the Staples Center in LA. They sold out the Bird's Nest, you know, the Olympic arena in Beijing the previous year. So,
and what are the people? The people who are watching this in the physical world. What are they seeing? They're not just seeing people working away on keyboards, right? They're seeing something else.
Yeah, they're seeing the game world. So they're seeing the players in the game world on screen, you know, playing with each other, competing with each other,
and on the Staples Center big screen TV, like they do for replays.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
Do you know what they charge for a ticket to sell that out?
You know, it varies, and it's just like in concerts, you know, there can be, you know, you might have your primary sales, but then there's also a secondary market of kind of scalpers and people on Craigslist and StubHub and the like, selling tickets for a lot of these things. And you know, in some of these games, like in Fortnite, you'll have, which we talked about briefly, you know, there's also an esports team. Basically, every major game today has is starting to develop an esports team or business. And this really started on the periphery of games where players just self-organized around, you know, forming these competitions and self-funded tournaments. And it was so compelling to gamers or to the audience that, you know, over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, it's really grown into a whole industry and to the point where, you know, the winner of the most recent Fortnite World Cup was a 16-year-old kid named Kyle Gielsdorf. And he won $3 million for himself for winning that tournament. You know, it's like more than Tiger Woods won for his 15th, you know, for his major title, right? So it's just massive.
Where did that money come from, that $3 million? Is that entry fees?
So the money comes from a few different places. A lot of it's from sponsorships and endorsements. Some of it's from, you know, the developers now of these game, these virtual worlds, these games have created entire leagues around their game. And so they'll do, you know, just like the MLB or the NBA or soccer franchises around the world, they'll cut, you know, individual team deals as well as league deals to, you know, sponsor prize pools and the like. Some of them are also player driven. So there's another game called Defense of the Ancients that does an annual tournament, which is called the International. And its prize pool last year or in 2017, I think, was $30 million. Which is more than, you know, so the winners of the International split, the top teams in the International split a prize pool of $30 million, which was largely player contributed. So, you know, the game has millions and millions of fans and players, and some of the purchases in the game go to this prize pool that then the esports team split up. You know, the winner takes $15 or $15.5 million home, and the remainder gets split amongst the other entrants.
And League of Legends, the League of Legends Championship, that was broadcast on ESPN, right?
It was, yes. It was broadcast on ESPN.
Like a real thing. That's right. And I'm going to, well, one more thing, because there's one other way that people make money in this area that is extraordinary. They sell subscriptions to let people watch them play games on YouTube, correct?
That's right.
So talk about that.
That's right. Yeah, so another way people make money from games today is they stream their own gameplay, or as you said, they post videos to YouTube. And a lot of this started, again, just like with esports, it started on the very periphery and the fringes of the industry. It wasn't really sanctioned. Developers didn't know how to feel about it. Players posting video of the gameplay, maybe giving away secrets of the game. But it's turned into this massive industry where if you're comfortable being out there online and you're entertaining, basically, these streamers, these gamers will turn on their video cameras on their computers, just like we are now to chat. But they'll also record their video gameplay and show, you know, often in real time, what they're doing in the game and provide tips and advice. And this is just a massive industry too.
How much, you know, money can you make at this?
So there's
it's a rhetorical question. I know the answer, but go ahead. Just, yeah, I did a little research, but go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, the top streamers make millions of dollars a year. There's a streamer There's a streamer named Ninja who even a couple of years ago, you know, disclosed he was making over $500,000 a month, $500,000 a month just from streaming. And like any new, like any form of media, you know, you attract sponsorships and the like here. And the really interesting thing, there's a third way people make money from games as well. And the interesting thing with all three of these things is they start off kind of with self-directed player activities, kind of on the fringes of games, and they're not really sanctioned by the game developers. Developers don't know how to feel about it, but then it just grows and grows and grows on its own, and developers embrace it. And the developers that embrace this stuff early on do exceedingly well with it. And I think it's kind of the third area where it's possible to make money today, but it's the newest kind of form and the most kind of open-ended for the future, is basically what we were talking about earlier with players trading amongst themselves or maybe paying each other for services. So I have an example of this from a few years ago. There was a game I was really into. I was playing a lot. It's called Destiny. But the game requires like a lot of time and dedication to get the best stuff or to be competitive. You have to play for hours and hours and hours a week. And I just didn't have the time. So you're not supposed to do this, but I hired a high school kid basically to play my account for me, and he like would get all the good gear, and then I could just jump in and like have fun playing the game directly. And so,
because you'd have a better sword, when you say the gear, that wasn't just the skin. It wasn't just you had a better costume. Right. You had Thor's hammer instead of just like a hardware hammer.
Correct. That's exactly right. And you know, you want to have the coolest looking stuff, and you want to have the best performing stuff. And so you're starting to see these economies develop around these games, and people generating income from that. And I think, you know, the next big kind of step in this revolution that's playing out, you know, year by year in players, you know, earning more income from the game, organizing, performing services for each other, is basically the introduction of property rights, you know, inside of games. Because, you know, today we talked about players spending $150 billion plus a year, $100 billion or more of that a year being on these virtual goods, but players really don't own, you know, those goods at all. They care about them a lot. They invest a lot of time and effort in them. They invest money in them, but they don't have any actual rights to the goods. They have like a limited license to use them. The developer can change the way that things work. And so kind of the next big, you know, change coming, I think, is the introduction of property rights in games and the development basically of market economies inside of these games. And you just see it on the fringes today, and it's getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Before we do, I want to have one more example of this surreal world. Mm-hmm. And just one more bit of cultural embarrassment. I had never heard of Marshmallow.
Right.
So Marshmallow is a music performer, and I think his most popular YouTube video is his song Alone. It's done pretty well, 1.7 billion views. It's probably just a few people watching it over and over again. But it's done pretty well, 1.7 billion views. But he gave a concert inside Fortnite. Yeah. What happened?
Oh, yeah, it's so cool to see this. So in Fortnite, which is a game we mentioned earlier, it's a game that has nothing to do with music, but it's just really popular. And in this game, you're in a really vibrant, rich virtual world. And again, hundreds of millions of people play this game every month, and they care deeply about, you know, their characters and the friends they meet online. They pull their real world friends into it. And so what the developer of this game did, Epic Games, is they set up a concert where Marshmallow performed in the virtual world. So you had to log into the game, link up with your friends, and it's kind of like going to a concert in the physical world. But you know, you all congregate together and watch Marshmallow perform some songs, and you can see the videos of the concert on YouTube. It was really cool. But they got over 10 million people. It's about 10.5 million people that showed up for the concert. So it's
a big arena.
Big arena. It's probably, you know, maybe the biggest concert ever. I don't know how big Woodstock is or
not that
know,
big.
Was or
yeah, probably. It's well, it was close. But of course, the further you got away from the stage in Woodstock, the harder it was to hear. But here, remember where you sat, you all felt like you were close, right?
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And it had a huge effect on Marshmallow's career and sales too. His album sales increased by 3x. His paid streaming online increased like two orders of magnitude, like 24x or more. So it's just tremendous. And they just did that again. That was about a year ago that that concert happened. But Fortnite just hosted another concert with an artist named Travis Scott. He's a rapper. You know, makes some really good music. And that concert was even bigger. Got about 12.5 million people that showed up for it. And it's actually really cool. Like, it's worth checking out, actually, because I went to the concert and went with my friend. And so, you know, he's a dad and he has two younger, you know, kids, and they all three play Fortnite together. And I play with them sometimes, and we all went to this concert together, and it was a really fun experience. It was mind blowing to see actually what they did with the concert. It was so cool.
Just technical question. Beside the artist before you, do you see any of the other people watching? How's that work?
You see a bunch of other people around you. You don't see all 12 million. You know, you see maybe a selection of 100 people or so kind of around you. And what's really cool about these concerts too is you have agency in them. So you can move around in the world. You can jump up and down. They do these in this most recent concert. They did these things where you transport into outer space and the song changes. And it was just a really cool experience.
So we need an Econ Talk episode, clearly, inside a... We probably wouldn't get into Fortnite. We'd have to pick something like last night or over the weekend or a different game, not as popular. I mean, that's it's just so extraordinary. Last question about this. When you're with your buddy and his kids, do you see them in their regular avatars? Are they recognizable to you in the crowd?
They are, yep. So you see them and you can all talk to each other just like we are now. And you see them and actually it's really cool. You know, for those virtual goods that they sell, they'll promote this kind of concert is coming up, and there's goods that are for sale. Like, you know, you can have a cosmetic, a skin for your character that, you know, maybe is a t-shirt for, you know, the artist coming up, or there's these little dance, you know, emotes you can buy, you know, so you can do the artist dance moves, you know.
And you don't have to socially distance, which is fabulous, or wear a mask. Right. You can go to a concert in the middle of the pandemic. It's I'd like you to invite me next time, okay?
Let's do it.
Yeah. Or get me into that Econ Talk thing, but we'll talk about that. So let's turn to this property rights question, which is nominally the sweet spot of Econ Talk. But there's so much to me that's so interesting about this. But this property rights issue, so let's say I'm in League of Legends, and I need a costume, I need an avatar, I need what the avatar wears. By the way, can I ever take what the avatar wears in the game and get a real life version of it?
There are developers that do that. So they'll sell a physical good that matches the virtual goods in the game. Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes.
So I need that, and then but then there are these tools, these resources. There's weapons. There's tools that help me unlock, open, climb, whatever they are. And in the game, it sounds like you can either buy them or forge them. Not forge. Mm-hmm. That's the wrong word. Unless it's made out of metal, I meant craft them.
Craft.
Mm-hmm. So you can craft them. When you craft them inside the game, you now have this device, hammer, phone, whatever it is in the game, and you get to use it the next time you play, anytime you play, sometimes, yeah, or always, or
yeah, it depends on the asset, basically. It depends on the good. So most of the time, you know, once you acquire the item, the good in the game, you can use it, you know, for as long as you like.
So if I upgrade and I get better and I win a better one, or I make a better one, and I've got this old one I don't really want anymore, and I could sell it to someone. Yep. I can sell it within the game in the marketplace that the game itself has set up, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can often, yeah. Not always, but often you can. And so you'll get, you know, the virtual currency in the game. Maybe it's gold or whatever it is for it. But what happens again is, you know, in every popular game, you end up with these, outside of the game, these gray markets or black markets where players basically want to trade for real money. For the good, so that they can, you know, take World of Warcraft, which you mentioned earlier. You know, you might invest a lot of time in one character. And in World of Warcraft, you choose what your character is going to be good at. It's called your class. So it might be a character who's really good at helping, you know, your teammates avoid damage or protect them from damage. It's called a tank, you know, in World of Warcraft. You tank, you take all of the damage. Or, you know, you might have a character who's a healer. So you don't do very much damage and you don't take very much damage, but you buff people up and heal people when they take damage in the game. Well, you know, you might spend a year playing one of those characters and invest, you know, maybe hundreds of dollars buying like items for the game, you know, for the character in the game, and eventually get tired of it and want to switch to a new character. But to do that, generally, you got to start from scratch. So you're used to playing with, you know, a group of friends and playing a role and competing in some of the, you know, top content in the game, and now you're back to square one. It's a really, you know, it's a jarring and kind of, it's not a fun experience for a lot of people. And so what they want to do is, you know, maybe buy a leveled up character that is equivalent to, you know, their paladin, their tank, and that is now a healer. And so this happens mostly on the outside of games today, but it's starting to come into games more and more with examples like Counter-Strike GO that we talked about earlier, where you're starting to get, you know, the beginnings of secondary markets and trading economies and, you know, eventually full-fledged, you know, market economies in these games.
This is like Ringo Starr said, I want to be a bass player.
Right.
But, you know, he's really good at the drums, but he can just, in this world, you can become a really good bass player if you have the right stuff. Mm-hmm. So my question is, I'm sure it varies by games, but isn't, in the real world, the physical world, if you have a really good drill, and I've got this cheap hardware thing, and yours is construction level and fabulous, I can go over, I can buy it. I can buy the drill. I see your drill and I go like, oh, wish I had that drill. I can go out and buy it myself. I can buy it from you. I can buy a new one. I can swap you my old one. I can sell my old one, buy the new one. So we have all this property rights and physical items.
Yes.
But in the game, how do I get the thing that I need to be a really good healer out in the real world? I can't get, how do I get into the game? Don't I have to get it inside the game?
That's right. And that's the issue is that it's really hard to do this stuff today. There's not a way to, you know, generally to trade. This is starting to change inside a game. So what would happen is you go to a third party website if you wanted to do this, you know, to buy, you know, that great drill. You would go to a third party website outside of the game and with no guarantee. So you have a lot of counterparty risk, you have identity theft risk, you know, credit card information risk, and you basically just make a payment to someone, you have no idea who it is, and hope that you will be delivered, you know, the good in the game. And so most games will enable a way to trade with each other, but there's no real property rights or money involved with the transaction. So you make a payment kind of outside of the game and then do a trade inside of the game. And, you know, so often players, you know, are defrauded in those types of transactions. So,
but the idea would be that if I came to your website, third-party website, bought the hammer there or the drill, and then I go inside the game, you're kind of promising you'll meet me in the game and give it to me? Yep. Is that what's going on?
That's right. And so you can easily be defrauded, right? I could just take the payment and deliver nothing. I could deliver the wrong item. There's the counterparty risk on both sides. And there's other examples of stuff like this working too. There's a new game called Animal Crossing New Horizons. It's a really popular game. Nintendo makes it. It's on the Switch, the Nintendo Switch. So little handheld console. And it's a really kind of a cutesy game, really adorable characters, and it's a virtual world. And each player in the game has a little island. And the purpose of the game is it's pretty self-directed. You can do all kinds of different activities in the game. But one of the things you can do is farm goods and then sell goods inside the game. But you have to maintain your island. So weeds can grow on the island. That's part of the system of the game. And it's kind of a tedious task to go, you know, weed your island. But you have to weed it in order to get the best output, you know, the best production from your island. And then, you know, you can sell the goods from your island to get the other stuff that you want. And so there's this, you know, wonderful, fascinating example of exactly what we're talking about here, where on Reddit, you know, which is a big social networking site, social media site, this person created a business, an actual business to de-weed your virtual island. So, you know, they advertise, they say, hey, we will, it started off just one person, you know, I will come to your island, give me your ID, your little ID, so I can navigate to your island, and I'll just pluck all your weeds for you. And, you know, they take payment in goods in the games, and, you know, they ended up hiring people and having hiring standards, and it's just fascinating to see this unfolding.
But in a lot of times, inside the game, the exchanges that take place are done either as barter, presumably, or within the coin of the realm, the coin that game uses to buy stuff. You can't become an entrepreneur. You can enhance your game playing, but you can't become a real full-fledged entrepreneur and earn a living from it.
Correct.
But that's going to change, perhaps. So let's talk about what Forte, your company, is doing. And this is, for those who are still listening, and I'm sure they're actually unlike other times I say this, I'm sure there are many of you, but for those of you who are still listening, as surprising as some of this may have been for you before, this is going to take it up a notch because, like, what is a, you know, what is the blockchain, which people associate with Bitcoin, right. What does blockchain have to do with game, with markets inside games? So before we talk about what Forte is doing, which is a little more complicated because it's a platform, what's the idea? What would be the outcome? If Forte did what it did well, what would players be able to do inside games that they can't do now?
Yeah, the outcome would be if we could wave a magic wand and kind of fast forward, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. What would happen is players would have property rights inside of games, those virtual goods that we talked about them purchasing. You know, they could trade with each other as they like. They could perform services for each other as they would like. And there would basically be a market economy, just like we see in the physical world and these virtual worlds. And it all kind of starts with the introduction of property rights, which is basically what blockchain enables. Blockchain gives you a way to have an asset, generally a digital asset, a virtual asset, and to have self-sovereignty over that asset and to control the transfer of that asset. And no one can take it away from you. And it would be wonderful to talk about it in more detail sometime. It might be
Talk about it a little bit now because I think, you know, I've done a bunch of episodes on Bitcoin and blockchain. They were long ago. I have a large group of listeners. They probably are gone, but they're not even starting this episode. But there are a lot of people, a lot of my listeners love Bitcoin. And so we did a bunch, and I was fascinated by it in the early days. We don't know where it's going to go still. But blockchain, let's give a little bit of background on blockchain. Blockchain is a virtual ledger that keeps track of the provenance of assets, virtual right. assets, right? It just says this asset was sold at this time. It's like a list of transactions, and it's verified by the activity of the participants, correct?
Correct. Yep, that's exactly right.
So how would that work in this case? So let's say I make a really good hammer inside League of Legends, and I sell it to you, and that would enter the ledger that Russ sold Joe a hammer, correct?
Yep, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, you know, a blockchain in general, which Bitcoin is one, you know, example of, and really the original example of, is a way to have a shared ledger amongst people and ensure that there are no fraudulent transactions amongst people. And that's a really difficult thing to achieve without having one or a cabal of operators that controls the ledger, and you know, you have to trust to verify it.
Like a title company. If you buy a house in the United States, you got to make sure that the person who sells it to you owns it. Just because they live there doesn't mean they own it. Obviously, they could be fraudulent, and you might not have bought it. So there's a very complicated, incredibly expensive, formal mechanism in the United States for the transfer of houses and physical property that's attached to land.
That's right. And it's cumbersome and it's somewhat fragile. I mean, it works, you know, obviously, but blockchains are basically a way to automate all that, to let computers do the work for you and where no one can change it. And so if we apply that to games, that hammer that we were talking about, today it lives solely inside, you know, the database of the game developer. And they can just, you know, change a bit in the database and you lose your hammer. When those goods exist, they become property that exists on a blockchain that, you know, the developer themselves or any little cabal of players can't control, then no one can take it away from you. You control the transfer of, you know, the value or the goods that are in your account or under your control. So that's sort of the central thing that's starting to change today.
But behind the blockchain that underlies Bitcoin is the idea that people are earning Bitcoin by verifying the transactions using a very complex cryptography algorithm, but they're basically, people have a monetary incentive, where the monetary incentive is denoted in Bitcoin. They have a monetary incentive to verify that indeed the hammer was mine and now it's yours, and I don't have it anymore, so I can't sell it again. Even though it's virtual, I can't, in theory, I can't use it again. I guess there could be different variations, but if it's, if we think of it as closer to a physical good, by selling it to you, I give up my access to it. And in Bitcoin, when I transfer a Bitcoin to you, Bitcoin miners around the world verify that transaction and earn Bitcoin, an ever diminishing amount of it available as from the way it was set up. How would that work inside the game world? How would there be? What's the incentive to verify transactions and ensure the property rights you're talking about?
Yeah. So what's really cool about the blockchain space today is there's much more functionality than, you know, what existed just a few years ago. So Bitcoin is one system in a really powerful kind of, you know, secure system for storing value and transferring Bitcoins specifically. But there are other systems today like Ethereum, which basically just have generic computing capabilities. So what the miners do, what the people that have the incentives to verify transactions in those blockchains do, as an example, and there's a version of this in Bitcoin as well, is they verify not only the transfer of goods, but the logic that governs the transfer of those goods. And that logic can be just arbitrary computer code, essentially. There's some limitations on it, of course, for safety and security, but the idea is you can have these complex rules that define assets or goods and that govern the incentive mechanisms and the transfer of those assets and goods between and amongst players. And each of those computations is verified by, you know, this system that's distributed around the world and no single entity controls. So it's a really powerful concept, and that's part of what, you know, games are starting to leverage and will leverage more and more, you know, not just Ethereum necessarily, but this general concept of the compute, the code that executes to define an item and to govern, you know, the transfer of value between and amongst the owners of the items can be verified and done so trustlessly. So you don't have to know anything about the system other than that it's verified by this group.
But the people who are doing the verifying in Bitcoin are making Bitcoin.
Yes.
Which has not taken off. It still may, but has limited usefulness out in the real world. No. Is that what's going to happen inside game economies? Are the people going to earn Bitcoin? Or are they going to earn what?
So they might earn a variety of incentives. So there might be in-game incentives. So there'll be multiple layers of this. So a game might reward people for contributing to its economy. So maybe you're, you know, a really great crafter, and by, you know, gathering resources in the game and creating these unique items that only characters of your type and level can create, you could not only, you know, acquire the goods and sell those goods inside the game, but also receive a reward from the game for doing that. Down beneath that layer is kind of the compute layer, which would be something like a global blockchain like Ethereum, as an example, that whose task is really just, you know, it's a protocol to verify the compute steps, the steps in code that would govern the thing that happens to be inside of the game, you know, this virtual good that you crafted as the crafter. And the people that verify that have a different set of incentives. Their incentive is to ensure that the code executes properly and that all of the transactions that are governed by that code were not fraudulent. There were no double spends. There were no faulty transactions in the system. And they are rewarded, in this case, Ethereum. You know, they're awarded ETH for performing those transactions or for performing those verifications.
But there's not... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, so there's different layers of, you know, this, which is what we see with other computing systems too. You know, there's different layers of computing technology. The internet's a great, you know, example of this. It's a protocol, which is what these blockchains are. It's shared and distributed globally. It's decentralized. No individual entity controls it. And it's just a protocol that people adhere to. And the difference here is that you're introducing an incentive mechanism inside of the protocol itself. So it becomes kind of an economic protocol. And you can layer these things together just like you do on the internet. There's the IP layer at the, you know, kind of in the middle of the stack. And then you might have TCP, you know, a transport layer on top of it, all the way up to applications like Zoom, you know, that we're using today, and that all kind of use these underlying protocol layers. And it's very similar to a game kind of at the top of the stack, leveraging the protocols underneath it to enable property rights inside of it.
So let's take, well, we're on Zoom for a minute. I'm sitting here in my office at home in suburban Maryland outside Washington, D.C., and we've all been doing a lot of Zoom work since the pandemic. And you notice after a while that some people have different things in their background besides their cookbooks and poetry section and whatever else is in the background of mine. And they put up images. And Zoom allows you to put up an image. And after a while, you see some of them don't work so well. The people look kind of weird. If you have an actual green, what's called a green screen, which allows a more neutral background to not look, it's a more neutral, a neutral background that doesn't do weird, funky things when you move, as some of the pictures do. So let's say I create this really incredible digital image for what's behind me, and I want to sell it. So right now, I just get online. I can sell as many copies as I want to you via Venmo, PayPal, cash, all kinds of ways to do that. Why can't there be something that's simple? Wouldn't the makers of games want there to be non-Ethereum, points inside the game? Like, wouldn't we want a real economy inside the game where there's just people who just specialize in skins or costumes and other types of things that make the game more beautiful? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what they want to do? Are there people working on that?
Absolutely. And that's basically all the game developers or the players inside of the games that, you know, craft these goods or trade with each other would have to worry about. The participants in the system, including the developer, really don't have to know all of the substrates underneath it. Just like, you know, today, in order for us to connect in that concert that we talked about earlier in Fortnite, you know, my friend and I and his kids don't have to know anything about, you know, internet protocol or the substrates underneath it. But that technology underneath the hood enables this functionality that was impossible previously for us to connect from different parts of the world and talk to each other with you know, no one in the way. Similar here, there's just, you know, an underlying enabling technology that really people that use the system don't have to understand at all. They just have to realize that as this, you know, develops, that you really can own these virtual goods, just like you do in the real world with your example of a drill. Like, you know, today, the way our legal and property rights are structured, when you purchase that good, unless you waive the rights in some way, you own it and you can do as you like with it, you know, generally. With digital goods, not just in games, but, you know, in other forms of media, you actually have generally like a very limited license to use, you know, the good. And in particular, what's difficult about virtual goods is they're ephemeral. They just live somewhere in a database. All a blockchain really does is provide a way to ensure that the goods can persist, that you can prove that they are the goods that are claimed. That's the provenance, as you mentioned, and that the transfer of those goods can be under the control of the individuals that own them in the same way that physical goods are or are supposed to be.
So let's make the let me try a different analogy for thinking about this. So I want to give a different example of Zoom. Let's say when we're talking, I don't want to look like Russ Roberts. I want to look like the Hulk.
Right.
Okay. So Zoom could develop that. They could develop a way for me to wear a Hulk, be a Hulk, have a Hulk avatar when I interact with certain people on Zoom, and I could choose to be my physical self or the Hulk or a beautiful woman, whatever, you know, a long wizard with a beard. I could choose anything I wanted. And alternatively, Zoom could create the equivalent of what Apple did and create the equivalent of an app store, a place where I could acquire different looks that would work on Zoom. And of course, Zoom would have to create that whole back end that would allow me to be able to transfer that thing. But Zoom would have nothing to do. Zoom doesn't want to be in the avatar business, but they know people like it. So they create this marketplace. In that world, in the App Store world, I pay 99 cents. And Apple in the App Store for Apple or the Android Store for Android phones, Google Play, they're the gatekeeper. They don't let, if somebody's defrauding people, they throw them off. If the avatar is vulgar, they might decide not to allow it. If it's got hate aspects to it, they might decide not to allow it. Why isn't that happening inside games? And then it would just be cash, mm-hmm. and avoid all this complication of blockchain and all this other stuff.
Yeah, so it is starting to happen in games, and that's actually the drive for blockchain, because you want a couple things to happen. When you start to have these marketplaces, just like you described, you know, theoretically could happen with Zoom or other applications, it kind of would all gravitate towards a system. You could call it a blockchain that would enable people to actually know they have ownership of the property rights, and that the owner, the gatekeeper, can't just take away their property at any time without trusting it, without trusting the developer or the owner, the gatekeeper, to do that. The reason you want that to happen is so that, you know, it's like safety and soundness in the real economy. You need this sense that you really do own these things. And here we can, because of the underlying protocols and the mathematics, cryptographically prove, we can mathematically have certainty that you do own it and that no one can take it away from you. It's like a greater degree of safety and soundness than we have in, you know, the physical economy. And so that drives more possible ascription of value, right? People, if you start to care about these things, which players do in games and would in other applications and marketplaces like you described, you would want to, you know, you would want increasing assurances that, you know, as your business grows or, you know, your income grows, that no one can take it away from you. Or maybe you start to do this full time. You make these great backgrounds or skins for Zoom full time. Well, you would really want to have assurance that you truly do own it and that you understand, or that there is an understanding of how the market actually works. And then you would want to be able to do increasingly complex things, just like we, you know, see in the historically with the introduction of the beginnings of property rights and the beginnings of market economies, and sort of the same set of the same evolution of agency will need to play out.
But the footnote to all that, of course, is that if I get really good at making Zoom avatars, or I was just thinking about houses in Second Life, you know, architecture in Second Life, or, you know, whatever, nice patios. It's true that I might be comfortable knowing that I own the patio that I can sell to, and that when you buy it, you get to install it in your house or wear the skin that I create. But it is subject to the existence of Second Life. Once, if Second Life dies, if World of Warcraft or League of Legends disappears, all the unlike the physical world, the digital capital I've created in that world disappears, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. And here, it would still exist, and you could transfer it elsewhere. You could sell it for other value.
When you say here, what do you mean?
In this world where, you know, these marketplaces leverage blockchains to govern the transactions between and amongst players or the people using the applications, creating the economic value and conducting the transactions.
You're saying that if I created a hammer inside World of Warcraft and inside League of Legends, and League of Legends disappears, I'd still have the hammer?
Yeah, you would still have the hammer or the value of the hammer. Maybe as the game starts to, you know, decline, you could sell the value of the hammer. But these are also protocols. So, you know, the good does exist outside. And another game could say, hey, you know, we saw you had this hammer.
We accept and, that.
Yeah, there might not be the exact same hammer, but you would earn some form of credit for having that hammer, and you couldn't defraud that game because it's on this open shared ledger that no one can control, including you. So they could verify that you actually did have that hammer, and therefore you gain this benefit. So what it does is create all these new market opportunities, essentially. And it creates, you know, a market economy that just has the potential to be far, far larger because you have all these new types of transactions that become possible.
But what I didn't understand is that, why does this have to have, say, cryptocurrency as the payoff rather than the U.S. dollar, the way that the App Store lets you transact in dollars. iTunes uses American dollars.
It will, yeah. It will be dollars.
It will?
Generally. Oh, it will generally, yeah. The blockchain is really just the means to the end. It's the underlying technology. There are cryptocurrencies under the hood that some people care about, those miners that we talked about in Bitcoin, right? But the end users won't necessarily use Bitcoin or ETH or, you know, any particular currency. They'll just be transacting in, you know, fiat dollars, US dollars or euros or what have you. Under the hood, that would be, you know, converted into the incentives and currencies that are native to the blockchain themselves.
So, naive question. I'm confused. So you could have the blockchain verified the provenance of these physical goods, mm-hmm. verified by decentralized users who would be compensated for that verification in actual dollars, mm-hmm. not in cryptocurrency.
They would be compensated in cryptocurrency because, you know, they're adhering to that protocol. That's what they care about getting paid in. That's why they're contributing their work or, you know, to validate the transactions. But you, Russ, could come in as a player in one of these games and just pay with dollars.
I understand. Someone okay.
Someone can accept those dollars.
But at the root of the blockchain, there is a cryptocurrency that is being doled out for people doing the computations that verify the accuracy of the ledger. Correct?
Correct. Okay. Correct. And the same thing in the game worlds. You might input into the system a dollar or a euro, but if you perform services in the game, you might get paid in the virtual currency inside the game, which is what we were talking about earlier.
Right, gold.
But you would also, that's right, gold. But you would have the ability to then sell the gold for dollars or euros and you use it to pay your rent or buy coffee.
So what's, now we come to the punchline of this episode. What do you have to do about, what's your role in this, Josh? What is Forte's, what are you doing? What's your daily life like?
What we're doing and you know, others in the space are trying to do is just make this easier. You know, everything we talked about is complicated. There's, you know, the development of all these market mechanics, the ideas of property rights and kind of getting game developers to think about it and embrace it. And then implementing all the technology so that, you know, they don't have to think through everything we just talked about every time they think about a new game or a new good or a new system inside of a game. So we basically create a set of tools that make it much easier for people to leverage an underlying blockchain, make sure they have these marketplaces where players have real agency and property rights and ownership in these virtual worlds that they care about, spend a lot of time and money in, and get the benefits of these market economies where you get positive sum exchanges between, you know, game developers and players and between players. Like today, game developers are generally, you know, they're just merchants. They're just selling goods to players. And the idea would be going forward, you create this virtual world, you introduce a market economy into that virtual world. And just as we saw kind of in historically the transitions from serfdom or command and control economies to market economies, there's just massive positive sums that emerge and everyone that participates in that economy can have more ownership and excess rewards.
But there'd be a lot of inequality. I'm just kidding. But there would be. And of course, there could be taxation and redistribution inside the economy.
That would all happen. Yeah.
Yeah, it could. Or people could say, maybe they'd have a different perspective. But is Forte's goal to create tools that existing games could add to their experience, or is it to create a platform where new games that were created on it would have this capability in a way that was different from current existing games?
Yeah, both.
Or both?
Both. So new games can be built kind of from the ground up to embrace these market economies and enable, you know, player property rights and just design their whole system, their whole game around that from scratch. But also we're working with a bunch of developers that have, you know, popular titles today with tens of millions and hundreds of millions of players in them to introduce property rights into their virtual worlds, you know, right now. So that when you purchase an asset in a game, you really own it, you can transfer it to another player, you can move real money, fiat money, in and out of the system seamlessly and create a great gameplay experience that operates, as you said, just like, you know, the app store or in-game purchases today. And get to your previous point, I mean, I think this is a really important one. It's one that motivates me personally for this stuff is one thing that blockchains enable is the introduction of ownership of equity and of incentive systems in technologies involving virtual goods and services and value, which is increasingly a larger and larger share of our economy. It's increasingly information economy. And so you can imagine these systems like in games where players have more access to the opportunity to earn income. they spend hours playing games today. And instead of today where you have to be either one of the top, you know, fraction of a percentage of the best players in the world to compete in esports, or one of the most entertaining personalities, you know, that play games and comfortable putting yourself out there, you could actually just play the game the way you like to play it and buy some things and sell some things and potentially earn income the way, you know, that person that created the weeding business, you know, the de-weeding business in Animal Crossing can do. And in a world of, you know, like we face today with the lockdown, you know, the ability for people to earn even a little bit of extra income from home would be great. And if you think about it, the numbers get pretty mind-boggling pretty quickly. You know, we talked about Fortnite, which has hundreds of millions of players that play it every month. And it does a couple billion dollars a year in direct revenue, which is massive. And it's like one of the biggest games ever. And so it's huge. And the game industry as a whole grows. But you can imagine, you know, a market economy developing in these games in the future, where maybe just a million players start to earn, you know, a livable wage basically by playing the game and conducting services and trading with people. If you had a million people earning, say, $15 an hour, you know, playing the game a lot, you know, maybe they're earning $30,000 a year. They're basically full time in the game.
They'd earn a lot more than that. They'd earn a lot more than that because they'd be playing more than 40 hours a week.
That's right. And probably having fun. But, you know, just that, you know, $15 an hour, $30,000 a year, a million people, that's a $30 billion game economy. And that's just the GDP, the turnover. And so that would be by far the biggest game that's ever created. That's that alone, that relatively small game of just a million people doing that. You know, that's bigger than the global music industry today.
And it creates the opportunity, obviously, for a niche game to thrive in a way. You wouldn't have to become the next Fortnite. You could appeal to a much smaller group and still those people could have a very powerful experience. I just have to say this because the only thing I really play online is chess, which is I just started because of the pandemic. A couple of my sons are into chess because of the pandemic. Oh, cool. And so, you know, I really like this idea that I could get an extra rook if I wanted to buy one in the middle of the game. Like I lost my rook. Can I get another one of those? And then the other thing that you could do on this is chess.com, and I mention it because I think it's such a incredibly well-designed website. But I'm stuck right now, I think, maybe not. I'm stuck right now with their pieces, their look and feel of the pieces. Mm. And I was telling my sons about Bobby Fischer, who was a very peculiar, strange man. But in Reykjavik, in his famous tournament against Spassky, I think it was that one, may have been a different one that came after, but he insisted that the chess pieces that were used in the tournament were fashioned by a particular craftsman in London, and a particular style. I think it's Stanton or Staunton. But, you know, why can't I have that set when I play on chess.com? I could be able to, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what I was thinking is it the right way to think about what you're doing, this metaphor of the app store? Is it to make it easier for, because what an app store does, and it's not a trivial achievement, and I think people now just sort of take it for granted. Oh, yeah, it's an app store. But it's an incredible achievement. It's really this virtual marketplace where a bunch of creative people, instead of Apple or Android trying to figure out what's the best weather app to put on a phone that comes with a weather app, but you can have 50 more to choose from.
Right.
Creative people can make money and get access to the users of the device. Mm-hmm. And so what I see, correct me if I'm wrong, what I see Forte is doing is giving the next game makers, and as well as the existing ones, the opportunity to effectively create that kind of marketplace inside their game to unleash the creative potential of people to do these kind of transactions. Is that accurate?
Yep, that's exactly right. And kind of carry it forward from there to create these rich economies. You kind of move from being, you know, a merchant to you have this virtual world. And so, you know, now you can have a virtual, like an economy in this virtual world. And it's kind of like you're managing a little country and, you know, you already want to create a great game as a developer that players love and, you know, is fun for them. And now you can create, you know, a system where the better you make the economy for your players, the more, you know, income they make, maybe the more they recruit their friends into it, the bigger the economy gets, the better it is for you as a developer because you have a stake in that economy as well.
Can you tax it?
Yep, you can tax it. That's the beauty of these systems is you can
take a, you can, take a cut as the
you can create rich incentives for systems, you know, so you could tax it, you could have transaction fees, you can have inflationary mechanisms. You basically get the equivalent of monetary policy, fiscal policy, you know, all the things that we see in real world market economies or physical market economies.
So the one thing that is perplexing, as if there isn't enough that's perplexing, but the last perplexing part of this is that what's Forte's business model? How is Forte going to, obviously you could sell this to game makers, but my understanding, I think, is that that's not what the plan is it?
Yeah. So our idea is basically we want to make it easier to create these economies inside of games, real market economies inside of games with property rights for players and for developers and these market mechanisms between them. And then, you know, us as the people that create these technologies, there's several ways we can benefit from that. One could be, you know, direct fees for some of the technologies. Another could be, you know, you'll need to provide liquidity in these marketplaces. You know, if you have an individual game can have thousands of types of assets in it, you know, all these virtual goods we've discussed, you know, throughout this talk, an individual game like World of Warcraft has tens of thousands of different types of assets and then billions of instances of those types of assets. And you know, how do you create liquidity for the long tail of those assets? How do you overcome cold start market problems in a system? What you end up needing is sort of market makers and that sort of thing. And so there's a bunch of ways that Forte and really other people, we're creating an open network where anyone can kind of jump in and provide liquidity into a system and, you know, other services inside of these networks. So, you know, our idea is basically we want to help make it easier to create these market economies. There'll be a lot of opportunities to do things like market make or provide liquidity into a system. And, you know, the bigger these economies get, the more lucrative that sort of thing could become. But it's an open network. It's a protocol no one controls. So we're not the only people or the only group that would be doing that sort of stuff. We just think, you know, we'll be there early and hopefully be good at it.
And can you tell me roughly how many employees you have? It's just you, isn't it, Josh?
No, it's we have a great team. I mean, that's one thing that's really cool about Forte too is we ourselves are decentralizing too. So this is one thing I love about these economic protocols, which again, you can think about the internet as a protocol, an economic protocol, which is what blockchains are, just introduce an incentive mechanism into the protocol itself. What it allows you to do is create new forms of economic organization where you don't need to be a corporation. That's our, you know, primary, you know, form of economic, limited liability company, you know, a corporation today, which, you know, as you know very well, as this obviously is, you know, your background, you know, the idea of a corporation or a market economy and property rights and currency and banking did not come to us from on high fully formed. This has been this iterative, controversial, you know, ongoing development over the course of time. And so, you know, what we're doing at Forte is actually creating a protocol that many people can contribute to. So we have about 90 people today that work on this protocol and this system. But it's increasingly an open protocol where, you know, we'll have developers, the game developers come to us and want to contribute to the core protocol or platform and, you know, earn rewards from doing so. And so it's this self-organizing protocol that really, you know, you don't need a corporation or me or someone in my role to direct, you know, all the activities that are happening. It's really just you define a standard and then people adhere to it.
You're trying to create a landscape that people can play in.
That's right.
It's a park. Right. It's a really beautiful and interesting idea. Closing question. How's it going? Are we close? You done? Where are we in the, you know, a lot of this, it's taken me a long time, Josh, but I finally figured out that sometimes something that people are really excited about doesn't always happen.
Sure.
So driverless cars, you know, 4 years ago, I thought by 2020, they're going to be here for sure.
Yeah.
AI, yeah, soon I won't even, you know, you fill in the blank. A lot of these things turn out to be harder than they were thought to be. And of course, part of the reason for that is that the people who've spent the money to take the chances on it have an incentive to overstate the, you know, the hype. It's just part of the natural human experience.
Oh,
so
sure.
Blockchain is one of those things. Blockchain was going to Bitcoin was going to replace the dollar. It was going to do this, that, and the other. It's amazing. It's still here. I don't think it's an incredible achievement that it exists and blockchain keeps people to keep trying to make it happen. Give me your prognosis as best you can as to, well, we'll start with Forte. Just where are you in the process? How far along are you? 80% there, 100% there? And what do you think? And where do you think this is going to go in the future?
Yeah, we try to be very soberly realistic about this. We think we're at the very, very beginning stages. We've been at it for a while now.
Did you start?
So Forte started initially about 2 years ago. And it's just a great deal of technology development that needs to happen kind of under the hood. So we're at the very beginnings of this, and we have a very, very long-term kind of patient horizon for it. We think this is a change that will happen slowly at first, and then all of a sudden, that's how the games industry typically evolves too. We're very patient and long-term oriented. That said, I'm very happy with the progress so far. We've been exceedingly happy with our conversations with developers. We're working with over a dozen developers already today. They have audiences that approach 100 million monthly active users, so 100 million players every month that are incorporating Forte today, and basically introducing these market economies that we just make it easier to enable. So I'm actually, we're much further along than I thought we would be at this point. But that said, we've got a long way to go, and there's no guarantees in any new sort of technology or system.
So. And you have competitors, you're saying, as well.
Yeah, I think in this space, there's actually just a lot of really smart people. I think really ardent people that care about trying to create new economic systems that can be more equitable and aligned and provide more self-sovereignty for individuals. So there's really just great people contributing to this space. I don't think we have like a direct competitor or anything, but there are other people thinking about blockchain and gaming, and we use some of their standards. We're all creating these open standards. So we use some of their standards. They, hopefully use some of our stuff in the future. It's this really pretty cool system that exists. And that's not to, hand wave faster. I'm sure there will be competition, but I and the people involved with Forte are happy to see that, because, the more people that work on this sort of stuff and start to pull the future forward a little bit, the better. And we'll just all learn from each other's protocols and create a system, that emerges again, much like the internet did, where, there were competing standards and over time, but eventually one emerges and, you don't have to be the one that created the dominant system. You really just can help contribute to the thinking and then see the system emerge and then, create all kinds of opportunities around that, like we see with, a large portion of the economy today that gets created around the internet and that sort of thing. So that's kind of what we're all working toward.
My guest today has been Josh Williams. He is the CEO of Forte. Josh, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Russ, thanks so much for having me. It's really an honor. I love the podcast, so thank you.
Thank you so much. This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.